This is Detention, a podcast dedicated to candid conversations about education. I'm your host, Dr. Nadia Lopez, a global leader, author, speaker, coach, consultant, and entrepreneur who opened a school to close a prison. Join me as I share my insights and bring fellow disruptors to serve time in conversation. Rebels, let's get into some good trouble. So here we are with another fantastic episode. And I'm starting out with, it's going to be another fantastic episode because every conversation that is brought to you here at Detention is all about bringing you those individuals who are, of course, the rebel and the disruptor, but people that I'm connected to who I know for certain have done this work. And as always, I'm excited to talk to my guests. This one in particular is my sister. Let me do the due diligence of introducing Diane. I don't have anything written down, but because I know her, I'm going to share. So Diane and I actually met in 2007 we met in 2007 while I was the intervention specialist / community coordinator / recruitment specialist /
all the things.
All the things at the Urban Assembly Institute for Young Women in Math and Science. At that time, I was a founding teacher. I was in my second year. But Diane and I developed this relationship because I was recruiting young women to enroll in our school. I held a informational at one of our partner universities, and I got to meet her and her amazing daughter, who is my niece, Jalen. And we also forged a partnership, a relationship, because I wanted to make sure that I was getting young women who could benefit from the type of environment our school was providing, especially as it related to STEM. And it was like we had known each other since we were born. And we became really, really, really close. And from that, I just developed this extreme love for her. And we are thick as thieves. In the process, when I decided I was going to open up Mount Hope Bridges Academy, she was one of the initial people that I placed on my proposal team. She offered her expertise. She lent her expertise to the portion of social emotional as it related to a guidance counselor and what young scholars, specifically those who are going from elementary to middle school, would really, really need. And You know, the success of the school has been in part because of Diane. She literally trained the guidance counselor that still remains at the school, Wesley McLeod, his wife. Like, what I do is I want the person who I know does the actual work to be the one to actually create the training model and really teach the person who has to fulfill the role of the guidance counselor, not as a bandage, but to actually do guidance work to impact the lives of young people. Phenomenal human being, but also a cancer survivor. So in 2014, when I was actually honoring Diane with the Conqueror Award for She Is Me, because we had the celebration of women in our community, she was one of our recipients, and unbeknownst to both of us, she was diagnosed like maybe a week or two prior to the event. And she was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer. And listen, we're going to get into that conversation because she, one, didn't quote unquote fit the description. She wasn't at the age that she should have been doing colorectal testing, because, you know, it was like, if you're not 45 or a certain age, you don't get it done. But all of that just speaks to what our needs are, especially as educators. But I was a witness to her process of healing. I was a witness to, going through chemotherapy and then finally being called into remission, but also her developing her own nonprofit, Beat Stage 3, which helped educate people, specifically those of communities of color, about the importance of health awareness as it relates to colorectal cancer, but she also covers a myriad of other health issues that affect our community, and bringing in experts and being an advocate. And so I wanted to give you all of that background because she's a well-rounded person. And when we talk about the child, she not only looks at it from the practical standpoint of the young individual, but what is going on in their community, what is going on with their parents. She takes a clinician's perspective, and she also practices providing therapy, direct therapy to families, to young children especially, because as you know, we don't have a lot of individuals of color who are providing those supports. And in our community, it is taboo to say, I need help. So she helps to demystify that. She has been a champion for so many of our kids, so many of us who are in her village who will want to take out our kids, but she intercedes. So we don't have cases in any way against us because we have provided our children with guidance. And so thank you. I thank you. Our tribe thanks you. But without further ado, Diane, I just want to say I love you. I love you. We are both wearing our Be Thankful t-shirts, courtesy of Michoud, that we bought, I think, last year or the year before.
Yep.
I
don't know. Together. Yep.
And I really wanted us to have this conversation because we always have good conversations and it's just like, why aren't we recording this? So literally 2 days ago, I was like, listen, it's just come on, let's go on the podcast. Let's have this conversation, transparency, so people know what we talk about, but also to help educate those who, you know, are struggling with different aspects of our lives. And so I wanted to start off with, before we get into the topic, because today's topic was around, you know, creating schools, safe schools, as it relates to our young people. But I would be remiss if I didn't start off with you. Hey, everyone. Before we jump into the episode, I wanted you to know that this is actually a two-part conversation with Diane Nathaniel, a mother, wife, guidance counselor, health and wellness advocate, mental health provider, a cancer survivor, as well as my personal friend. I had the pleasure of meeting Diane back in 2007 when I was hosting these open houses for the Irvin Assembly School for Young Women in Math and Science. It was a new public school serving 6th to 12th grade, and her daughter Jalen at the time was in the 5th grade. Diane and I's chance meeting has morphed into this beautiful friendship and sisterhood, which led her to actually serve on my advisory board when I was writing the proposal for Mount Hope Bridges Academy. She trained the school's guidance counselor on best practices, as well as being a force in supporting many of our families. In 2014, we were devastated when Diane was diagnosed with colorectal cancer. She was only 45, but to witness her strength and a new passion emerge out of this life crisis was beyond inspiring. In part one of this conversation, she and I discuss her health journey as well as mine and what it took for her to fight for her life, go on this journey into advocacy, which has become her purpose, and why education is so critical in dealing with life-threatening health issues. She will also share how the demands within the education industry impacts the health and wellness of those who are serving significantly, especially in the era of COVID. This is a transparent and candid conversation that many educators need to have and be aware of what is necessary in order to take gentle care of you, but making sure you prioritize yourself. It's time to serve detention. Let's talk about Diane Nathaniel, the cancer survivor, and the journey to and what you continue to go through.
What an intro. Like, I'm taking Nadia on the road. You understand, right? I don't want nobody else to introduce me. I'm going to take Nadia. So proud of you. Like, this is so dope. You stay creating and creating inspiration for creative people. I think you have unlocked that Pandora's box where we all feel marginalized and pigeonholed into our career title. And you have figured it out. You're like, listen, educators can do everything and anything. So thank you for something new yet again, right? I'm here for every single thing that she's created, all successful. And she's so self-reflective that if she feels like it's not getting the traction she wants, she's like, okay, on to the next, right? She doesn't need to be her. And it's always inspirational where the rest of us are like, you know, you make us feel like we could do it too. And so thank you for the community that you have created for all of us who feel like counseling is all I can do and teaching is all I can do in a classroom setting, right? You have really given us a few platforms where we can have conversations with you about how to expand ourselves. So mm-hmm. I guess that lends to the self-care, you know, as a cancer survivor. I guess my education really in my career role and what I do on a daily helped me, one, to heal myself, but then to turn it around and show other people how to heal themselves and how important just awareness is. Being aware is everything. We talk about self-awareness all the time. So we have to employ that in every aspect of our lives, especially health. If you're not healthy, you can't do nothing. You could be a millionaire, billionaire, whatever you want to be. But when you're sick, you are just a patient. And I think helping people understand how to hold the people who are caring for us accountable when they are not delivering quality services to us, when they are not treating us with dignity, integrity, and kindness, and empathy, and all the things they demand we walk in with. I just love showing up to tell people, here's how you show up to your doctor's appointment. One, you're going to have something to write in. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a pen and take some notes. And when you don't understand, here's where you don't feel ashamed to ask questions. I was not ashamed to ask questions through this cancer journey. It's new to me. I'm like, I'm 44. Your screening age is 50.
Right.
And then to learn that Black people have the highest incidence and mortality rate, why is the screening age still 50? So I wrote the CDC to ask them. When I found out who creates the baseline, I sent an email. Of course, no one responded. I sent another one just saying I'm in late stage colon cancer. So first of all, I must have had a polyp at the age of 34. That was cancerous because it takes a polyp 7 to 10 years to turn into cancer. So when I'm complaining since 34 of fatigue and weight loss and migraines and constipation, and I kept getting dismissed because I was a young woman who didn't look sick, or I just had a baby, or it's your menstrual, or it's all the things, but no one tested me. No one further tested me for anything else other than you're anemic. Most people of color are anemic. Why are we anemic? How is it okay to say that's a commonality, but we're not talking about why that is so we can combat it? So it was a series of things after finding out that I was that I had cancer at 44, and I thought back to 10 years previous, it just made me mad. Not angry, mad. Like, I was mad. And after not getting a response from the CDC, it was probably like maybe 3 months later that I got this letter from the White House. I thought it was a joke, right? Some big yellow thing came in the mail. I wish I had pulled it out and know we would have this conversation. And I was like, the White House, right? Anthrax is probably in this envelope. I'm not opening. And I promise you, it must have sat there for like 2 or 3 days. And I'm shaking it around. I'm like, okay, God, protect me as I open this. And in that envelope was a letter from President Obama and Joe Biden thanking me for sharing my story. And I was like, I never wrote the president. Like, what are you talking about? Apparently the CDC forwarded my email to the White House. Mm-hmm. And now March 15th is colorectal day, but March is now colorectal cancer awareness month. And I'm thinking, is this a deterrent just to get me off the trails to find out why this baseline is still 50? So while I was proud and having that moment, I advocate with the American Cancer Society. At that time, I was already an advocate. I shared it with them. And they talked about this moonshot that Joe Biden was going to be giving, where it was like $2 billion for cancer research. And I'm like, oh my God, like this is a real thing. Somebody sees it. And then we started, you know, pushing a policy around colorectal cancer awareness and the screening process and why Black people have all these barriers to screening. And that's why so many of us are dying. And as I go every year to Cancer Lobby Day and Summit, I'm always the person they put up to talk to either Chuck Schumer or Hakeem Jeffries or Kirsten Gillibrand, like all the Congress folks. And I'm thinking, why am I the only person, you know, y'all put up? And they're like, because most cancer patients die. They don't live in the stage 3-4 era, Diane. And so you're like this anomaly. I had to like take that in and say, whoa, really? And I don't think I knew the magnitude of my sickness or my illness because I had a wonderful support network, right? Nadia included. One day I answered my phone for some days and my doorbell rang and it was the whole team from my home.
That's why I need you to go and check up on her because I don't understand why she's not answering. I deployed my team. Y'all can leave. Thank you. Now. It was like last period, something. I got your classes covered. I need you to go and check up on Diane. Now, mind you, Diane didn't work for me. Not during the school year. During the summer, she worked for me. But no, because we take care of family. But go ahead, continue. I'm sorry.
That's like, what are you doing here? And it was actually a chemo weekend because I did chemotherapy every other week, 48 hours, 2 hours in the doctor's office. And then I would go home and I would have a nurse come and reconnect all my medicine. And I would just be immobile for like 48 hours with this machine attached to me. And they got a chance to see that. So to this day, I don't know how they received it. Most people didn't talk to me about if they came to chemo with me, how they felt about it. Most people didn't tell me. Even my children are just telling me how they felt about me going through that process. But the day they came, my blood pressure was like 161 over, it was ridiculous. And so I remember my nurse, Bill, he kept taking it. Mm-hmm. And in the room, I was kind of trying to scan the room, see how they were all taking it in. And Nadia was sitting on that side of the living room. Everybody was just like, you know, I could see the anxiety. Like, cause he said, if this doesn't come down, we're going to send you to the hospital. And I was just like, no, I'm not going to the hospital. My friends came by to see me. I can't go to the hospital. Come out. And he's like, yeah, maybe it's the excitement from the visit. So he left the blood pressure monitor with me and it stayed that way for 2 days. And I did have to go to the hospital and get like fluids. My blood levels were just, it was so much chemo at this point. And anybody who doesn't know, like chemotherapy is cumulative. Like your first two or three visits, you might come away with, you know, oh, it's not so bad. As it accumulates in the body, it starts to just deteriorate you. And that's what started to happen. But I was so glad to see them. So I think the support network that I had is what really got me through. And then just the determination to fight and save my people, because I felt like we were just not being given the information. I didn't know anything about American Cancer Society. There was no information in my doctor's office. Why not? There was no one of support to come in and speak to patients to just kind of guide us through, or here are your next steps. You know, if you experience this side effect, here's a nutritionist. Here's from the headaches that you'll probably get. Here's a neurologist. None of that existed. So in creating Beat Stage 3 and the Village Lighthouse, those are two of the things outside of being a school counselor, I knew that I wanted to do to make impact, to, you know, create more positive health outcomes for Black people in every area of health, because we're plagued with all of them, right? Diabetes, kidney disease, renal failure, prostate cancer, breast cancer, you name it, Black people have it. And we always die. We always have the highest mortality rate, which something is wrong with that. So I think my school counseling, you know, gives me the lens to help people through the trauma that all of those diagnoses cause. And then helping families to see that the disease is not just of the person, but it's the family that has to really deal with it. And just kind of walking them through what that process looks like, just like I do in school when a kid gets a diagnosis. It's not just that the child has ADHD, mom, right? You now need strategies to deal with your child who is exhibiting all these behaviors that you don't even know how to tackle. So I think everything is interdisciplinary. And I just, you know, I'm really trying hard to figure out a way to just complete that model and make it make it holistic for our families. Everything's not medicine. Some stuff is just us talking.
So here's the thing. You're talking about you're trying to figure it out, but let me be a witness and say you have figured it out, right? It's a matter of the rest of the world needs to know your existence, which is why you're here. And, you know, we, because this is what happens. We were supposed to talk about something else first, but then I switched up the questions, which is fine because it makes a connection. What you talk about is very valuable in educators and just people in general as a community. And when I say community, you don't have to be of a certain race community. It's just the community of humanity. Let mm-hmm. me say that. Mm-hmm. You have to have a real understanding of where people come from and some of the reasons why certain neighborhoods appear to have such a high incidence of a particular health issue. Right. So in particular, in Black or Brown communities, Latinos, right, specifically, or low income, because we could also just say it has to do with class as well. There's an assumption that we don't care. There's also this qualification of those people don't want better. And that's not the case. What we fail to receive is, as you stated, a quality of education, a quality of a bedside manner from a doctor and his staff to educate us on what it is that we are being diagnosed with. Because one is the diagnoses. Then there's, what does this mean for my life? So there's the treatment aspect. But I want treatment to be related to impacting my health and wellness, not just to sustain me for the rest of my life by giving me medication, right? Exactly. There is the aspect of what do I need to eat? What do I need to do in terms of exercise? What complications will come with the medication? What do I need to do in order to prepare my family? What support groups are there available?
Yep.
What follow-up questions do you think that I should be thinking about as time goes on? And I share this because, as Diane stated, the screening age at that time in 2014 was, they were at, if you're not 50, especially if you went to your doctor, you would have to argue and prove the case why you needed to get screening before. And because of your advocacy, because you were part of the American Cancer Society, you had to do a lot of the legwork on your own to find out who's the contact person, what's the office in New York, right? And you just become a representative for those of us who were either affected directly or had family members who were dealing with it. So like Diane would be my go-to person. Anybody's diagnosed, okay, I got somebody for you, right? Like she was my go-to person. And I think that that's so important because there is a direct connection between the healthcare system and the education system.
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
And so I will say this, and I'm always talking about the next episode I will share. I definitely will share in an episode around my own personal health issues, but I will say this, when I was going through it, I called Diane crying. When I was going through my own health journey, because literally to be diagnosed was one thing, but no one explained to me. And y'all, my background is in nursing. I practice, nursing, went to college, got my BSN, and realized that wasn't my calling. And so I went into telecommunication, then education. And then when I found myself sick, I'm the person that all my friends call me when they're in the hospital or going to the doctor. And this is what you need to ask. But there's something about becoming the patient and you lack the confidence to ask the question. It's almost like you become like jello. You don't remember anything. You just like, I don't know what's happening. Like you become so fearful because I was diagnosed with kidney disease, which I'm like, no one in my family has kidney disease. I found out my uncle had it, who recently passed away. So I have to find out specifically what kind, but Needless to say, there was no real history of kidney issues. There was high blood pressure. Both of my parents, my mother has it and all of her siblings have it. My dad doesn't have it. I don't have cholesterol. My mother's side has it. I don't have diabetes in my family. So the fact that I had all of these things that I didn't have all of the traditional things that were linked to kidney disease baffled them. But at the same time, there was no education. Just like you said, they didn't give me papers to explain to me, well, this is what the kidney disease is. They didn't give me a phone number. I had to find the American Kidney Society online and call them and ask if they could send me brochures and give me a nutritionist, because I also felt like, I know there's things I shouldn't be eating, and I know that there's certain ways that I need to protect my kidneys in whatever stage I was in. They didn't talk to me about what stage I was in. I had no clue. And so I had to do my due diligence. And when I didn't have the answers, I was like, Diane, honey. And the steroids had me bonkers. So I was super emotional. And I remember Diane saying, I got somebody on my board for her nonprofit. And I was like, she was like, he's the head of nephrology. And she said the doctor's name. And why was the same doctor who was sitting here jerking me around, not giving me what I needed?
He's been fired, by the way.
He has been?
Well, for me.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so Diane was like, shut up. And I was like, Diane, that's the same person. And then she opened out the name. And I was like, that's him. Literally, somebody who was on her team did not have the bedside manner. And then Diane became my advocate. She's calling all of these people and they apologized to me. And then he eventually called me into his office and he was like, I spoke to you. I sat with you. I said, go and look for your notes. I got time. Go look on the computer, get the notebook.
Wrong one. That's first of all, right? She's too hard for all of us how to take notes. That's why I got all these pens, y'all, in different colors.
Yeah,
so I was like, the wrong one that day.
No, sir, you didn't contact me. And so I didn't, I was just like, you didn't give me a plan. He was like, oh, I usually give a plan, a medical plan to my patients. I usually offer you all the information and assistance. So I was part of the unusual, right? And I'm thinking to myself, as I said to him out loud, do you know how many funerals I've gone to for children whose parents have been diagnosed with one thing, but it's become complications. So it's like, you can diagnose somebody with diabetes, but you fail to tell them to stop eating certain foods. Mm-hmm. And so now because of complications, they die of cholesterol, they die of high blood pressure. They have to have their, you know, appendages amputated, and diabetics have poor circulation. So now they're dying because of necrosis, septic necrosis, right? That it goes throughout their whole body. There's just so much people die of as a result of us not getting the proper education. And I said, and then constantly saying Black people, especially like when COVID came out, that was the thing. The Black people aren't taking care of themselves. And it's like, but you're not educating me on what this means. Mm-hmm. So that was a mouthful for me, because I just want folks to understand how the things that Diane and I learned from each other was, I always tell her, you need to take notes all the time, right? And then when I went through what I went through, I was actively telling people, make sure you have an advocate. Make sure you have somebody you can go to. Either they go with you to your appointment or you speak to them. Because Diane was able to say, did you ask for this? Did you contact this? Because I couldn't think of all those things.
You can't think of it. Yeah.
And that's so important. So that is our health lesson 101. She is now in remission and she has created this nonprofit, which I think is really important for folks to also understand, because when you talk about educators, and sometimes we don't see the beauty and value out of our circumstances, how it could create something else for us, which can either become an act of advocacy or just another stream of income, but can have tremendous impact on the lives of others, right? Just talk a little bit about what your organization does, And then some of the things, if they're, you know, the resources that are available, because I know you have some Facebook conversations that were had that may still be available for them to see.
Oh, awesome. So Beat Stage 3 Inc. was created between myself and one of my other best friends, Helen, my oldest friend. Like, our parents were best friends when we were kids. And so we've been friends for, good God, 50 years, right? That's mean to say out loud.
Okay. I'm going to let you say your
whatever, okay? And after every chemo treatment, I would hashtag Beat Stage 3. And so Helen came up with this idea. She hadn't seen me in a really long time, and she had come to New York, and she just couldn't understand why I didn't want to come outside. And I was like, well, my skin has changed. I lost all this weight. It's like this constant like darkness. You know, you can tell when folks are sick, when there's renal failure and when there's cancer, people can kind of tell when you're going through something based on the way you look. You just get this look. So she was like, oh, you're beautiful. We need to highlight this in like a photo shoot. And I was like, what? So literally, she does this photo shoot, and I'm thinking it's going to be me and her on her iPhone, but she set up like this amazing day with herself, who's a professional photographer, and she had me glammed up, and she styled me, and we went out to Central Park and did this amazing photo shoot, and I thought like, wow, the level of confidence that that gave me back, and the inner beauty I felt on that day and outer beauty, just like my whole mental wellness was being fed. I was like, how do we do this for other folks? Mm-hmm. And she was like, well, let's create an organization. Let's call it Beat Stage 3. And I was like, oh, that's dope. So she was like, well, write up a purpose. And I did. And before we knew it, like, I had no idea she was making this. I knew we were incorporating. I did not know it would become a nonprofit. And today it is, you know, one of the cancer fighting organizations for survivors, thrivers, and people who have lost their battle. And it's about raising awareness and teaching advocacy to folks to self-advocate, because what if you don't have somebody like I was blessed to have to go with me on the day I needed to go, and same for Nadia, who didn't have someone to go with her the day she needed to go. So it gives all types of toolkits and advice for you, how to find a doctor, when to leave a doctor. Okay, because we get into this abusive relationship, right, where we think we can't fire the doctor or find a new one. And that's what Nadia had to do. You know, you're worth it, all of it, whether you have insurance or whether you don't. So just working with families, you know, to do that. And then just also creating events in the community so that people have some way of meeting a doctor if they don't want to go in an office. I've been partnered with the medical and the healthcare professional community to come out of their offices and educate our community. Just as Nadia said, it's not always someone's going to pick that pamphlet up, but you know, Brooklyn, we love a good event, right? So we love to eat, we love to drink, we love to socialize, we love music. So we do these CAPE events, which are Cancer Awareness Protects Everyone. And that's to bring the doctors into the community, because they will see more people in the community than they will have walking through their office, which they mm-hmm. found valuable. So and that's one of the things that we do. And then the Village Lighthouse is new. It's a patient advocacy consulting firm. So when patients are diagnosed, what do I do? You know, so I try to walk them through that process, provide some counseling, some level of mental health to the family as well. So because some people have children and they don't know how to communicate. My, you know, your dad or your mom is ill. So I do a lot of that work. And then I sit on a few grants. We've been selected as like the organization where people come to for a patient advocate to sit on the grants. So if doctors are trying to do clinical trials, it's now been a law or a requirement by the NCI, which is the National Cancer Institute, or the CDC or NIH, which is National Institute of Health. Whoever you want to get these $2 billion grants from, you have to have a patient advocate on your team. And so we've been fighting a long time to say, doctors, you're not the experts unless you've had the disease. Exactly. Patients are the experts. And so they found value and they see the true value and the connection in that, right? We would have a connection. You just give me medicine. You don't know what the side effects are if you haven't felt them. And so finally, they're seeing that voice. So we're sitting on 4 grants right now, some really big ones, and to do with colorectal cancer specifically. So I'm excited about that. and more to, you know, more to come, but that's really it's a big community thing, and pushing Congress to pass some policies and bills that directly affect people of color and folks who are low income and are elderly who are on Medicare. There's so many bills that give insurance companies that give surprise billing. And that's why people don't go to the doctor, because they can't afford it. And that's a barrier that should not be. That should not be.
So I can't say enough of how proud I am of her. And I want those who are listening to just know that you're not alone in your experiences, if you've ever had one with a doctor who did not treat you with respect. You're not alone in being diagnosed with a life-threatening disease and trying to figure out, like, what do I do next, mm-hmm. and not getting the help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we share this with you all to be vulnerable and transparent because, you know, there was parts of me that felt like I should not be going through this, right? Like, there was a part that I almost felt embarrassed because you have a nursing background. You are an educator. You're a thought leader in your position. That meant nothing. That means absolutely nothing. Because let me tell you how the healthcare team that I had to deal with treated me. Like, I was the average person who came in there with no insurance. And mm-hmm. I had to remind them. I said, I just want you to understand, I got good insurance. The only reason why I came to this hospital in Brooklyn is because I can't drive myself to Manhattan. Like, yeah. It was too much on my body. It was too taxing to go to the city, to find parking, to pay for parking, because right. everything was coming out of my pocket. And the Department of Education had cut me off as well. And I literally had to go to the hospital. I had so many doctor's visits. So between getting blood work done every 2 weeks, going to the doctor every 2 weeks, I had to have physical therapy because of complications, because of the steroids. I had to go see a orthopedic surgeon every month. I had to go the nephrologist plus my primary care. So I had to stay in contact with the primary care because he was the one making sure and becoming my advocate as well. Like, make sure that you are communicating with the nephrologist and having him send your information to me. You know, make sure that he's looking at this specific area of your labs. And if he saw something, he was like, let me contact them because they're not paying attention. Even like when I was developing steroid-induced diabetes, he was like, your sugar's high. And I was like, what? He was like, your sugar's high.
Wow.
Did they tell you about like the implications when you're on steroids? I was like, no. He was like, no. He was like, call him and ask him. Now, the reason why he didn't directly say to me what it was, because he was teaching me. He was like, and then call me right after. Let me hear what he has to say. And when I told him my sugar was high, they asked me, are you eating? What are you eating? And cakes or cookies? I was like, I don't eat cakes or cookies. Like, what are you talking about? Well, you can't even have simple sugars. Well, first off, they should have started with that. I said, simple sugars is like fruits. I eat fruits every day. It's summer. Mango, strawberry. My mother's making me smoothies. And she was making me smoothies with beets in it, right? Like fruit juices. First off, beets are used to make sugar because it has a high concentration of sugar. So she's thinking, I'm helping you to clean out your blood system.
Yeah.
No, it was actually making me sick, right? And so now they were like, oh, we're going to have to put you on medication for diabetes. I was like, so what we're not going to do is that. What we're going to do is get me a dietitian, a nutritionist. And then they gave me some guy who was telling me I could eat all the foods that I knew I couldn't eat. Like, I can't be eating spinach right now. I can't be eating sweet potatoes. Those are high in potassium. And he was like, no, you can eat them. I was like, no, I cannot, not while I'm trying to heal.
Right.
So I had to find a specific person who deals with my specific disease to offer me the support that I needed, because what he was saying was wrong, which would then cause me to have further complication, right? And so it's exhausting. It's exhausting to fight for yourself.
It's exhausting.
When you're already trying to fight for your
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous. And you get turned off. And because you get turned off, this is why we see in our communities that people don't go to the hospital, because you're making me feel like I am a deficit. You're making me feel like I'm bothersome to you to ask the questions that have to deal with my health. And I should not feel in any way, shape, or form that I cannot ask and advocate and expect a clear answer. And if you don't have it, then go look for it and get back to me. So when I went to the doctor, he was like, yes, you pay too much and they have a responsibility. He was like, that's why I knew it when I sent you back there. He was like, I was going to give you the answer, but if you don't check them, then they're going to do it to the next person.
Yep.
And that's the problem, right? And he was like, and there's a lot of elderly folks, especially from the Caribbean, who go to that hospital.
Yep.
So they have a responsibility to make sure that someone is taking accountability. And I was like, thank you, Dr. Anderson, for making me the advocate while I'm sick. He was like, well, okay. You know who you are. He said, you want work? Here's your work.
And so, I like him. Yes.
So yes, he's Jamaican. I really appreciated him and the process, but I also had to have a village. And so, you know, anyone who is dealing with any type of illness, if you are newly diagnosed, just know, one, the advocacy, finding someone who may, especially if someone has a health background that you know, ask them questions. Mm-hmm. Have somebody go with you to the hospital. Make sure you have a notebook to take down notes. You can also ask for your records. Every time you go into the doctor's office, they can print out the notes from that particular day. Any test that you take, have them make a copy and give it to you. Have them forward it to your primary care so that they also have a running record of seeing what's happening, because you don't want to disconnect between, if there's complications and you need to go to see another doctor. For me, the nephrologist wasn't necessarily talking to the orthopedic surgeon. He was just like, oh, well, you might need to, he referred me, but they weren't having conversations. My primary care was like, so this isn't working. Like, it's not working. And it's because people have you on this medication, and the medication is actually making you even more sick. Why do they have you on so much? It's not doing anything. And I was like, oh no, I don't know why. I was so over it, but I'm grateful to that. I'm grateful for my team. Now, I do want to ask you this question, because this is the part where we often don't talk about the implications that work had on your personal well-being and exacerbating, if anything, as relates to your health before and what you're going through now.
Wow. So I think when you work in as a school counselor, or if you're right, it's just different than the social worker, and it's different than the school psychologist role. And often school counselors get like this rap of, we don't even know what you do. That's because we do everything that you don't. Period. Okay. That part. Right. And we're often seen as band-aids, which is insulting, because I have a master's degree in school counseling and I have a Harvard certificate in treating students K through 12. So at the end of the day, we are not respected like everyone else. So we're often doing the most, like doing the most. And yeah, while there's some counselors that are not, that's them. I don't even communicate with people who don't do the most. So I don't know who those counselors might be. Anyone in my tribe, my immediate circle, have all had their health compromised because we do the most. And we're requested for it's heavy work, you know, like ACS cases, child abuse cases, neglect cases, all the behavioral challenges that happen, you know, fights happen, and kids are expressing that they're depressed, you know, even in elementary school, and families break up and they get divorced and they're blended families and it's not a good, you know, it's not a good relationship, or parents die, grandparents who raise the children pass on, drug addicted parents, like drug addicted siblings in the home, right? It's just all these things that our kids are exposed to that comes to the counselor. And then when you get home, you got your own family to deal with. No one ever considers that we have a family. No one. I think people just think we go to work, we show up as educators, and that's it. Your kids now are mine.
Yeah.
And I don't have my own. And then just trying to find peace within to even deal with the issues in your own household can be very difficult. Then there's a lack of sleep because there's all the reports that have to be written or the staying late. And so you don't even get to eat. Well, let's talk about not going to the bathroom. Let's talk about not having lunch, because if you have lunch, you're taking a bite of something. I know I was reheating coffee 4 times a day. I would have the same coffee that I made in the morning when it's time to go home. It's still on my desk cold. And realizing that this is an impact, not sleeping, coming home with the stress of, oh my God, this and this has to be done the next day. And where's there enough time if I don't stay late? And I can't stay late because I need to go to the doctor. How many appointments have I missed being at work? I no longer go to work on a day I have a doctor's appointment. I don't care if I have time to cover it or not. If I have to get doctor, just have to doctor me, because what happens? My appointment could be at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but if I go to work, nobody respects it. I need to leave at 12. Right. Even though I've said I'm leaving at 12 on such and such day for a doctor's appointment, no one cares. And so now I have learned to care about that. And I'm just like, no, I'm not coming to work, because I've given so many opportunities and grace to you to come to work so I can, you know, join in whatever needs to be done and do my part and then go handle my self-care, right? I've already had a near-death experience. I'm not going to allow a job or a person to help promote that again. That's not happening. And now in recovery, we're dealing with the COVID situation. So I'm extremely compromised, right? And I don't know that I feel like the system as a whole really cared about. It was almost like if you put in an accommodation letter for true and real, you know, immune issues or underlying conditions when COVID hit and schools had to close, I felt like we were looked at as we didn't want to work, right? That was the scenario. That was what was put out there, that people just don't want to work. They're making up these diseases, these conditions. I'm not a person who ever wants to wish bad health on myself, because I know that without my health, I'm immobile. I can't do anything. So I can't imagine that everybody that put in a condition was faking it. What should have been looked at is how many people with conditions were showing up at work.
Yep.
And though I'm sick, I come to work every day. Even though I'm sick, you didn't even know, because I don't bring it into the building, right? I do what I have to do to make sure that I'm okay to come into work, and then I go home and deal with my stuff. That was never talked about. That was never said. And of course, somebody like me who had cancer, they approved me right away. And so I was home, but Nadia had to make me stay home because I did still go to work. I think I went to work for like the next 2 months until she was like, no. And then it was like, everybody was getting COVID in my building. With no children, teachers were being affected. So it was like, I couldn't be there, right? Because I came too close too many times. So I did put in an accommodation finally. And I worked from home. And I do feel like there was just a purview by other folks that we weren't working, that we weren't doing anything. And that was hurtful to be coming from a job where one day we're frontliners and you love us. And then the moment we do what we have to do for ourselves and families, you want to fire us and we don't want to work and we're lazy, we're shiftless, we're all these things. So I think now I have just figured out, like, I don't stay 6, 7, 8, 9 o'clock anymore. I got to say that our administration team has figured it out, right? Because COVID made you figure it out. Everybody can't stay late anymore. So what things can be shifted to remote platforms? So I think we have done that. I don't think that, I feel like as a mental health professional, what we're seeing in the pandemic children is what this has been labeled. It's going to be difficult within the next five years. Because the support that we needed in social emotional learning from the Department of Education, and yeah, I'm saying it, it did not happen. We needed the support professionally for adults and teachers and educators, and we needed it for kids. And I know that I asked, like, please, can we not focus on grades and numbers and data when we return? We need to make sure that the trauma everybody felt, everybody, but I have teachers who lost family members. Mm-hmm. Really, you know, we lost a student. in our community. So how are we just going to show back up and return to school like business as usual? It can't be that. And that's what it has been. And that is what is taking a toll on what you see playing out in schools right now, all over the country. It is not just New York City. It is literally all over the country. And we've done a lot of deeper work on our own as a school to provide mental wellness to our families and parents, and not just through me, actually hiring people to come in and talk about it. I have a lot of children who are now expressing, questioning their gender identity, or have figured it out. And
well, before you get into that, because that's where we segue, our segue. But because clearly what I want to do is separate the conversation, just simply because we spoke so much about our own personal health journeys. And I wanted to capture a couple of things that you said. And one of them was the fact that you were willing to go back to school, even when you were given the approval to stay home. And I tell you, I was like, Diane, if I got to get on a plane and come up to New York, I will do it. And she was like, no. I was like, I'm not playing with you, Diane. You cannot put your health on the line. Like, we didn't go through this together for you to now compromise yourself again. And I don't care how anyone is guilting you into this. They're going to have to explain to me why my friend and my sister's not here on earth. That's going to be a whole other situation. So you're not going to work. And like 2 weeks, like I was at a point where I was like, I'm not even talking to her because she is playing. She's playing. And so, you know, I know what it's like as an educator where we feel like we have to show up because what will happen to the children? What else? Mm-hmm. Like, this is our obligation. And the thing is, you should never feel like you have to give your life to empower and save other people's children. And when I say other people's children, listen, I love every single scholar as my own, but at the end of the day, I can't claim them though on my taxes, right? I'm not trying to be funny, but if I can't claim you in any way, shape, or form, if at the end of the day, the first thing they say is, who is this person's parent or guardian? And it's not me. I can't be sitting here putting my life on the line because who's going to explain that to my kids?
Exactly.
And my significant other, there's no explaining that. So no, that I was like, no, that's not going to happen. But the other thing is Diane ended up going to work. And like, she ended up recently having COVID, right? And that's, they took away the mask mandate. Yep. And it was a matter of it's, our schools are the safest places. Yep. You don't need them. She got vaccinated. Even yep. though the doctors had already told you the percentage is very low for your coverage because you're still immunocompromised. Yep. And it was a back and forth, and their folks and their medical team was adamant about, if you get vaccinated, you're fine. You can come to work. And then you end up with COVID and now have like these symptoms, lingering symptoms, which we don't know how long we're going to last. We don't know if it's going to create further complications.
Yeah.
Right. Speak to that.
Just having a doctor's visit literally on Thursday. And that was the answer. I was like, how long is this going to last? It took so long to put me on something when I was having this cough through the pandemic and it wasn't COVID related. It's some sort of gastroesophageal problem that I have. So they put me on a new med and it had been working. And now I'm coughing back to that same level, if not worse, again, like I can't get sleep because of it. And the doctor just said, you know, basically she doesn't know how long it could last. Some people have the strain that I had was the new variant. How do they know that? I have no idea. I think it was my symptoms that had to do with my extremities being affected, where I had like this really painful leg pain in my thigh, and they thought it was a blood clot, so they sent me to the hospital to have an ultrasound, chest x-ray. Like I was literally dragging my left leg around. I couldn't sit up. couldn't lay down. It took a really long time, like, to just drive. There was nothing there. And then they said it was related to the COVID strain that I had. And it eventually dissipated the leg pain, but the cough is still here. The fatigue is still here. Give me like 5-6 o'clock. I'm in the bed. I don't have the same stamina. I'm forgetting a lot, which I already did from chemo brain, which I hate to claim, but ooh. So just can't remember a lot of things. So I'm seeing a neurologist within the next week just to have that checkup anyway. I had to request it though. And then as I was leaving, I was asking like, well, is there a cough medication that you could give me? Because this is not sustainable, right? My chest hurts, my diaphragm hurts. And so she prescribed some sort of antibiotic for me that I haven't picked up yet. I need to go do that, but I'm afraid to go back to work. Right, so that anxiety of returning tomorrow and having the same group sessions with those students that I had like 13 students in my room. I just can't do it. I can't do it. And I know that's gonna have an effect on them because we're building this entrepreneurship program. It's also my kids that I was gonna be talking about where they get to come and talk about the most private things that they are afraid to share with their families. And so now, and they do it as a group because it's easier to know that someone else is going through what you went through. So separating them is not an option. So I don't even know how I'm gonna approach that tomorrow. I haven't even really given any thought because I'm still processing. Like I did everything I was supposed to do. I stayed in a mask, hand sanitizers everywhere in my room. The HEPA filter is in my room. And so the doctor was like, everyone's gonna probably get it one time in their lifetime, and just any place that you walk outside, imagine, you know, that you've walked into a positive case. You know, I get that, but I'm pretty sure this was from work. And it happened literally the week, like you said, after the mask mandate was lifted and everyone's just, you know, you know, free. And so I can't control what other folks do. And here I am.
Thank you for sharing as per the request to share. This was important. This was important. And I wanted folks to really get a sense of who you are and what your journey has been, because through it all, you are still dedicated to the young people, right? There are plenty of folks who had decided through the pandemic, whether it was in the beginning or as things started to alleviate, or you know, the mandate started to be lifted, they were just like, enough is enough. I can't do it. Every single decision you made, you always think about the children.
Yeah.
Always think about the families, even the ones who turn up and want to curse you out. You always think about their personal well-being. Yet and still, there is a system comprised of people who don't see you as a human being making sacrifices that would not only affect you, but your children as well, right? Mm-hmm. Like to not have you means that your immediate family would have a loss, as well as all of us who love you. And for me, I have told Diane time and time again, you know, think about what your transition in terms of exit plan is going to be, not because I don't want to see her as a guidance counselor. I think she is phenomenal at what she's done. I know and have seen the influence she's had on the guidance counselors, the guidance counselor in my building, and others who are now in other spaces that are flourishing. But at the same time, I don't believe in harm caused by your workplace.
Yeah.
Believe in anyone staying in any situation where you're not honored. I don't like any type of environment where people pacify you and make you feel important because they need you. But at the end of the day, you're still placing me in a position where I'm almost bullied into doing the work that you need me to do.
Yeah.
As opposed to you recognizing that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
You know, this isn't it. So it's not easy. She has two organizations that she's working on. She still continues to have her caseload as a guidance counselor. She is still providing private practice therapeutic services to families and children. And that's because she is truly servant leadership, where you show up and you answer the call, and you still have us as a village that you take care of, and your own personal family. So just on behalf of all of those folks, I want to say thank you, because you're amazing and I love you.
Pleasure. I love you more.
And I thank you for being part of detention, because sometimes the disruption isn't outright, even though we have done protests and we have been on the cover of the New York Post.
Wow.
But that's neither here nor there. But the protests can just come in activism and educating people. And the more people are educated and the more they have knowledge, they can then become disruptive themselves and say to those in positions, I'm not accepting this. This is not what I deserve. And have been a living testimony to that, especially when it comes to the healthcare field. Because even most recently, a friend who we have in common, you know, going through their own cancer diagnoses, you know, not knowing what to do, feeling like I have nothing left to live for, like almost giving up. And I had to be like, Diane, I need you to step in.
Yeah.
And so thank you for that as well. Thank you for serving time with me here in detention. Don't forget to subscribe and to tell a friend, so that this way you're up to date on new episodes that will drop every week. You can also follow us on Instagram at Detention Podcast. If you want to learn more about my services as a coach, consultant, and keynote speaker, go to www.thelopezeffect.com. And let's stay connected on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by following me on my handle, The Lopez Effect. Lastly, if you have any topic ideas, questions or comments, or want to sponsor future episodes, please send me an email at detentionwithdrnadialopez@gmail.com. All of this information will be in the show notes, so don't worry if you didn't get it down. I also want to send a gentle reminder to my disruptors and rebels. It's okay for us to get into a little bit of good trouble, but please take gentle care of yourself, be well, and never forget to choose you.